This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, which means time for the Week in Review, starting with the rough week for Maine's Governor Paula Page. Yesterday, Democratic and Republican state leaders met in Augusta to talk about LePage's voicemail tirade against a legislator. They're continuing those discussions today, but haven't yet come to an agreement about what to do with LePage. Here's Maine House Republican Minority Leader Ken Fredette.
I think this governor is well aware that he's on a very short leash, that people are watching. Republicans are watching. Democrats are watching. The nation is watching. And he needs to continue to be respectful, to understand that he has said something that's horrific and that he needs to be accountable for that.
Fredette's referencing that expletive-laden voicemail that LePage left for a Democratic state rep last week.
I want to talk to you. I want you to prove that I'm a racist. I've spent my life helping black people, and you little son of a socialist.
Well, then, as the backlash grew over his remarks, this week, LePage said this on a Maine radio station.
And it's really one thing to have one party behind you. It's another thing not to have any party behind you. So we have to move Maine forward, whether it's me or somebody else.
That set heads spinning, but later the same day, the governor tweeted about premature rumors of his political demise. So we'll dig into the LePage story and the rest of the week's news with our Week in Review panel. Joining us in the studio is Tiziana Deering. She's an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Boston College and also a member of WBUR's Community Advisory Board. Tiziana, good to see you.
Hello.
Also with us, the Boston Globe op-ed columnist. Sorry, Dante. You've been here so frequently, I should be able to do this. Boston Globe op-ed columnist Dante Ramos. It's great to see you as well.
Great to be here.
I keep saying with a name like Meghna Chakrabarty, I shouldn't be mispronouncing anything on the show, and yet I do. So first of all, let's get your reaction to the ups, the downs, the lefts, the rights, the spinning, the unspinning, the waffling. I don't know what you call it with Maine Governor Paul LePage. Dante, let's start with you.
I almost can't believe I'm saying this. I think Paul LePage is revealing himself as the less varnished and more erratic version of Donald Trump.
He did claim that he was Trump before Trump was, right?
I mean, and I think that that's not a trivial thing for him to say. And it's not just in terms of the politics. I mean, his background is not a conventional government background. And you know, I think there can be benefits to having non-traditional candidates for office. But in the case of LePage and in the case of Trump, too, you have people who were somewhat loosely attached to the idea of governing and to the kind of art that it takes to actually make that happen. And there's this almost, I don't want to call it an authoritarian cult of the, you know, the businessman who comes into office. But, you know, I think that there's a frustration for people in that position because they think that they can just order things and it'll happen. And when that doesn't happen, it just becomes something that makes them feel in over their heads.
Tiziana?
Well, I want to start with his tweet about his, you know, the rumors of his political demise are exaggerated. Dude, this is demise, right? He may not be resigning from office and he may not be thrown out of office, but you can't have a week like this and not have some demise going on. He is a weakened chief executive of a state who has shaken the faith of his party. There's some demise going on here. And, you know, the Trump theme, I think, is a really important one because a little bit I find myself thinking, if people are wondering what this temperament question, whether it's real or whether it's sort of been made up for Trump, it's real. It's happening in Maine. And if you wonder what it's going to look like after someone like Trump is elected, we're playing that out in this kind of bizarre morality play in Maine right now.
It's an interesting point because, I mean, you know, some people have the discipline to stay on script and then maybe that version of themselves continues on when they're off script. But I guess you're implying that you don't see that discipline in either Paul LePage or Donald Trump.
No, and it's a discipline that is both possible and necessary. And one of the things that, you know, the juxtaposition of what's happening with LePage and Trump is doing is really raising the question of a more sophisticated understanding of what it takes to lead. And we, when we make choices as voters, are choosing the whole package of leadership. And it is raising interesting issues about what it takes to be an effective leader every single day.
I think it does. You know, if Shakespeare were alive today, you know, we'd be reading Paul the First, the tragedy or something. You know, the idea that there is an essential personality that people bring to the things that they do is something that is obvious in the Trump campaign and obvious in the LePage situation as well. You know, you hear LePage's fellow Republicans essentially asking for him to be a different kind of person. And, you know, I think the average person on the street knows, like, that's just not even possible. And yet there's a certain amount of political expectation that, oh, yeah, you can just change and be this conventional, normal, non-voicemail leaving governor.
Yeah, you know, but there are many people who don't want him to be any different, though. I mean, he's not a governor with zero support in his state. Politically, amongst party leaders on both sides in Maine, obviously, there's a problem, Tiziana, as you pointed out. But I mean, the very fact that, and I return to Donald Trump here, that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee tells us that the kind of unedited, unvarnished, at times, you know, if need to be expletive-laden, as Paul LePage was, that style of leadership or politician is on the ascendance, maybe?
Well, so it's interesting because everybody loves that person who blurts out what they wish they could say sometimes, even against the better angels of our nature, right? The really bad things we wish we could blurt out. Sometimes it's very gratifying to have someone else do it. And I think hopefully the N of two of Paul LePage and Donald Trump, although I would actually lump Chris Christie in this same wheelhouse, right, doesn't necessarily indicate that it's on the ascendancy versus a trend that's happening smaller. At the same time, that doesn't mean it's right. That doesn't mean that just because people like it and they're willing to vote for it, that they're going to be pleased with the results of executive leadership and getting things done that then happen afterward. And we might wind up with a really painful voting hangover, you know, in lots of different cases if we're going to continue to put people who don't have that last piece locked in.
Dante, on Wednesday, Paul LePage told reporters that he will no longer talk to the press, quote, ever again, and that he's, quote, tired of being caught in the gotcha moments. I'm not sure what to make of that.
I'm not either. I think LePage has done quite a good job of putting himself in the gotcha moments. And another comparison you could make to Donald Trump is that he's mad at the press essentially for faithfully recording the things that he actually said. And, you know, the things that he said were kind of impolitic and hurt him politically. And it's not the press's fault that he actually said those things. It's not as though he's been misquoted.
Well, plus, that voicemail was not in the press. He left that on a guy's voicemail and then said on the voicemail, give this to the press.
Yeah.
Lest people not know I'm coming after you.
Exactly.
And he ended his voicemail with a thank you, too, which I always have to know. But okay, so actually, this is a great opening for us to sort of kind of reacquaint ourselves with some of the context of how LePage got to this point this week, because he has been saying repeatedly things about the opioid crisis in Maine and his claims on who's trafficking opioids into Maine and his claim that he believes that they are all African-American and Latinos bringing the drugs into Maine, comments which he has actually stood by, and he did so even this week in Boston because he was here for the Conference of New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers on Monday, and he said this.
The heroin fentanyl arrests are not white people. They're Hispanic and they're black and they're from Lowell and Lawrence, Massachusetts, Waterbury, Connecticut, the Bronx and Brooklyn. So I didn't make up the rules. That's how it turns out.
Well, guess who that caught the attention of? The mayors of Lawrence and Lowell, Massachusetts. They both spoke on WBZ-TV. And in this clip, you'll hear from Lowell Mayor Ed Kennedy and then Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera.
I was a little bit outraged and surprised. I think it just shows that the governor of Maine is ill-informed about the issue completely.
You know, we're the New England states. We should be working together. We shouldn't be trying to figure out who to point fingers at. And at the end of the day, really, it is a national problem.
So this is exactly something that I have been struggling with for 2 weeks now. Everybody in New England cares about the opioid crisis. I mean, I don't understand why Paul LePage felt the need to bring in this incendiary racial claim. Do you guys have any thoughts about why, Tiziana?
Yeah, I do, actually, because I was thinking about this, right? I think, in part, Listen, the opioid crisis is a serious, serious issue when we need serious people with serious approaches to help solve it. And if you don't have those things, one strategy that politicians have used since the dawn of politicians is scapegoating. And when it's not Maine's fault, because it's somebody else's fault, and that somebody else is sending their bad people into my state, it's a substitute for serious understanding of the data, serious understanding of the evidence, and serious public policy development.
Dante?
I agree 100%. I think that the opioid crisis in every state where it exists, you know, represents a health problem. It represents a rip in the social contract. It reflects the kind of negativity and lack of hopefulness that a lot of people are feeling out there. And it's something that really goes to kind of it's something that, you know, deep in the soul of Maine and all of the other states that are grappling with this, that we really need to be thinking about. And it's just easier to blame a demographic other for something rather than engage in the kind of introspection and, you know, tough, you know, case by case work to solve the problem.
Right. Well, you know, in the interest of facts and fact checking, the FBI Criminal Justice Information Service has some numbers from 2014. And in that year, 1,211 people were arrested for selling or making drugs in Maine. And of those, 14% were black. And so, you know, again, obviously a very different set of numbers than Paul LePage claims to be getting his information from. But something tells me we're going to keep talking about the governor for maybe a couple more weeks, if not even more than that. So let's switch gears here and give us some time to talk about another major story in this week's news, and that it comes out of New Hampshire and a development in the prep school rape case at St. Paul's. Now, the victim of that case actually went public this week. She's Chessie Prout, and she told NBC's Today Show that she still struggles sometimes with what happened to her when she was a freshman, but that she's no longer afraid and wants to be a voice for others.
Even when I get my panic attacks and I lock myself in my closet because I don't want my little sister to see me like that, and she comes into my room sometimes and she'll come into my closet when I'm rocking on the floor and punching my legs trying to get myself to calm down. And she'll try to give me the biggest hug and she'll say, "Chessie, you're okay, Chessie, you're okay." And I just can't imagine how scary it is for other people to have to do this alone. And I don't want anybody else to be alone anymore. I don't.
Well, her identity was kept secret during the trial last year. Tiziana, what do you make of her decision to speak publicly?
You know, I've done a lot of work over the last few years thinking about the power of your story. What it means, how intimate it is to share your story, and what a gift it is to share your story with someone else. And that was the first thing that struck me about her decision and her interview, is that after suffering from this violent intimate act, she found the strength to share that story as a gift, which is, I think, what she said it was intended to be, but I think it's what it is, too, to others who might be feeling isolated or victimized and can just hear one more story of survival and of moving forward. I'm sure lots will be said about this, but I think the gift of sharing that kind of story should be held as important and in the center of this discussion going forward.
Dante?
I think if you look at the coverage of these types of cases over the years, you'll look back and you'll see that there has been a tendency to be very protective of the victims. And given the history of what's involved, I think we all understand that. That said, I think it's laudable and maybe, you know, very helpful for lots of other victims. If Chessie Prout is out there, it kind of dispels the idea that if you were a victim of sexual violence that you need to be hiding in the shadows. You know, we wouldn't expect someone who's been the victim of a burglary or the victim of some other, you know, a car accident or some other type of crime to sit there quietly and suffer through their experience on their own. And to the extent that this case shows young women that, you know, that there's no shame in what happened to her, I think it's positive. And I guess it should probably make a lot of us, you know, rethink, you know, the tendency to assume that victims, you know, should just always remain anonymous.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting because just as to remind folks of Prout's fellow student Owen LaBrie was convicted on 3 counts of misdemeanor sexual assault last year. He's appealing those convictions. And meanwhile, Chessie Prout's family filed a civil suit against St. Paul's School earlier this summer, saying the boarding school failed to protect the students from this type of behavior because the assault happened in part of in the context of a school tradition called, it had a name, the Senior Salute, where students reportedly involved themselves in sorts of, quote, sexual conquest before graduation. Now, St. Paul's made a statement issued to NBC News that said, "We categorically deny there ever existed at the school a culture or tradition of sexual assault." Now, it's interesting because it depends on how you interpret what the tradition of the Senior Salute was. But it challenges me to fully believe that administrators at a school with a close, intimate community, like a well-respected boarding school like this, wouldn't have some indication that maybe there was a tradition going on that could possibly lead to trouble or had led to trouble in the past, Itiana.
A, I find it implausible. B, especially, it's a boarding school full of teenagers. So one would expect that there would be a very active management of the sexual culture of that environment, let alone we deny. If there was a name for it, it was part of the culture and it was happening. And if you run the mental exercise of what would have happened if at every level of that institution, the mantra had been no sex in high school, no sex in high school, would you see a Senior Salute emerging and an administration who says we categorically deny it while alumni are saying, yep, that's what happens? So it's just, again, from a sort of leadership perspective, it's very hard for that to be a plausible claim. Now, I wasn't there. I get it. But it's hard for that to be a plausible claim.
Well, the St. Paul statement to NBC News continues. It says, however, there's no denying the survivors' experience caused us to look anew at the culture and environment. This fresh look has brought about positive changes at the school. Dante?
I think just going back to something that really both of you had said, in these very small, close-knit academic environments, I think that cuts both ways because you can, you know, it means that the adults can be more involved in and more aware of what's going on in the kids' lives intellectually, educationally, and otherwise. It also means that some of these environments turn into these little weird monocultures that are isolated from the outside world. And if you accept that the Senior Salute is a thing that happens at this school and everybody knows kind of what it was, even if people don't really know exactly what the contours of it are, you know, everyone's sort of ambiently aware of it. And the reaction that you would want people to have, which is like, wait a minute, this really shouldn't be something that's a custom that we celebrate. You know, there are no outsiders looking at this with fresh eyes. Everyone's deeply immersed in it to the point that it takes on a certain level of normalcy.
Yeah. You know, I want to go back to a moment to the fact that Chessie Prout, I mean, we can say her name now because she has publicly spoken, but during the trial last year, her identity was withheld and wasn't reported in the press. And I wanted to ask you, remind everyone about that, because I did want to ask you guys about a story that was reported this week in the Globe about another case in New Hampshire as well, which actually could have an effect on rape shield laws. This one is actually a horrible, gruesome murder that happened. The victim was strangled and then raped. And this happened back. A conviction came across in 2014. The convicted person is appealing his case, and in part of the appeal, and this is going to be argued in front of the New Hampshire State Supreme Court, his defense attorneys are making the request that the victim's sexual history be unsealed. Now, you know, obviously, that's the case is going to be heard before the New Hampshire Supreme Court later this month. But a lot of sexual assault victims advocates around the country are looking at New Hampshire now and feeling a little concerned that 40 years of rape shield laws and traditions of keeping people's identities and own sexual histories private during these trials may be at risk. And Tiziana, I was wondering what your thought is on that.
They should be deeply concerned. I mean, what that begins to imply and what gets implied then can become believed and then becomes the basis for future public policy. And what that begins to imply is a rolling back of our real evidence-based understanding that rape is not about the victim's sexual history. It's about an act committed in the moment by the perpetrator. And to conflate those things when people in that field have worked for decades to unconflate them. There's probably a real word for that, but I don't know it.
Deconflate.
Thank you. Is that a real word?
No.
Deconflate those things. It is now. Really should be deeply, deeply concerning to victims' advocates, I think, everywhere.
It is a little bit ironic. I think one of the reasons why someone like Chessie Prout would feel comfortable coming forward is precisely because of that deconflation that has happened over the years. And people realize, okay, that's not something that Chessie Prout did. And this isn't, you know, that she's not tainted by this. She's not, you know, this is not a reflection on her. This, you know, the case that you're describing, Magna, seems to cut in the other direction.
All right. Well, it's always kind of tough to make the turn from these very serious, heavy topics that we make to our hubbubs, which is, of course, those stories that maybe were a little lighter, but still deserve a little time on the radio. I like to do them, though, because it is Friday afternoon. We're heading into a long weekend, so I want to put a smile on everyone's faces rather than talking about the doom and gloom that does seem to surround us at times. So, Tiziana, let's hear your hubbub.
All right. So it's been a very dry summer. And the summer isn't the only thing that's been dry, because if you're a college football fan, you've been missing a reason to wet your whistle with whatever and eat a lot of barbecue and hot dogs for as long as 9 months. But the drought of college football is over. It is College Football Saturday tomorrow. The football season is starting, and I think students and alumni are going to celebrate off the back of pickup trucks everywhere. The football powerhouses of MIT and Worcester Polytechnic square off on the gridiron tonight at 7 o'clock. And then this weekend, Boston College is preparing to rumble in the moors of Ireland against the obvious opponent, Georgia Tech, because that makes a lot
They're
of sense.
They're playing in Ireland?
Against Georgia Tech.
Okay.
And the likes of Harvard and Dartmouth are demurring for another week in order to let students to pretend for one weekend that some homework is going to happen. But the drought is over. It is college football time.
Hooray. Dante, your hubbub?
Well, speaking of wetness, the last few weeks here in Massachusetts have been noteworthy for a spectacular series of marine life sightings off of Cape Cod. Last week, you may have seen the viral video of orcas 12 miles off of Chatham. There was also an 8-foot manatee that made its way up the coast from Florida and was spotted off of the coast also of Chatham. The seal population all around the Outer Cape has rebounded, so you can see them literally everywhere. Not coincidentally, great white sharks have closed beaches in Provincetown and Truro because they show up a little too close to shore. There's also another recent video of a shark devouring a seal also off the coast of Provincetown. That one was a little bit too real for my taste. It's like a snuff film about seals. But it's also a reminder that marine life, it's not just a cute decoration for our beach time. They were there before we were. Glad to see him back.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a success for conservation efforts in a way. I was wondering whether or not the manatee should, if it's not such a good thing that the manatee made it this far north, given that, I don't know, the water shouldn't be so warm for a manatee.
Maybe the sharks will take care of that.
Oh, no. But you're right. That the seal video was
sorry, that was dark.
They're the mermaids.
It was dark.
Yeah, okay, poor manatee. Okay, swim back to Florida before it's too late. All right, so my hubbub has to do with the fact that, you know, we've got the digital information boards on many T stations now. The question is, do they provide you with information that's actually useful to you as an MBTA rider? Frequently, they don't. So that led two loyal MBTA writers to launch an online excuse generator that spits out made-up excuses for MBTA delays. One of them, Todd Ching, he said, you know, sometimes you'll see an excuse like signal problems at downtown crossing, but what does that mean? So the MBTA excuses generator, which I'm pulling it up right here, will do things like, Green Line, minor delays due to a lack of interest in maintaining this pointless charade at Leechmere. We hope you enjoy waiting for an hour for three buses at one. Oh my God. I'm laughing because that has actually happened to me multiple times. Okay, let me do this again. Orange Line, moderate residual delays due to an earlier horror at Ruggles. We are pretty sure this makes us a world-class city. The MBTA excuse generator. Look at it. Look for it when you're stuck on a red line train between, you know, Porter or Central and Harvard.
I'm waiting for an excuse to come up that a shark ate a manatee. That's my dream.
We'll give you another one. Blue Line, minor residual delays due to an earlier hometown down at Suffolk Downs. We suggest continuing to stare blankly into the middle distance while you wait. Well, that's enough for the Week in Review. Tiziana Deering, associate professor in the School of Social Work at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Community Advisory Board. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks very much.
And Dante Ramos, Boston Globe op-ed columnist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.